Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett. Welcome to another edition of Speaking of Reliability. I'm here today again with Fred. How you doing, Fred?
Hey, good, Adam. Doing well.
Good. You're fresh off vacation, so very well.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I don't know about very well. It's the 2 weeks prior to the trip was trying to get everything done ahead of time and finish up some projects and get things in motion for while we're gone. And then this past week has been a blur of getting back to people and following up on stuff and getting caught up. So yeah. Today I feel like I'm back and it actually slept through the whole night. Jet lag on the backside was just as bad as going there. So
So you're fully recovered from reentry.
That's right. I think so.
Good. Good. Well, great. Well, you and I were having a little discussion about, you know, categorizing field failures and how that can affect the analysis and the way the issues are addressed. And it was kind of fun, so we decided to record it.
Yeah, I've got an opinion on that. So let's talk about that.
Kirk Gray here to mention that John Paskowitz and I published a book, Next Generation Halton Haas, Robust Design of Electronics and Systems, which provides the basics of applying Halton Haas and reveals how Halton Haas can discover software issues also. To find out more and get a copy, go to exendoreliability.com/go/halt.
You know, it might be a really short episode because I could just, you know, when you get a field failure, if a customer says, hey, this isn't working, whether it's a consumer product or industrial product or any product, the customer says, hey, this isn't working. And it doesn't, whether it's in warranty or not, that's a financial transaction, an obligation. That's, if it's not working, it's a reliability problem. And I've had that question so many times, Adam, where they say, well, how do we sort the field failure data? How do we deal with this? And I'm like, well, if it costs you money, it's a reliability problem, period. Right? It might not be in warranty, but it costs you future sales. If it costs you brand loyalty, it costs you money. If you have to do a replacement or a repair, it costs you money. If you have to answer a phone call that somebody says, hey, I'm not sure what button to push, that's a reliability problem.
Right.
And then from there, then all the normal ways of sorting come into play. But I have one of the things you'd mentioned when we were chatting earlier, though, is a customer was sorting it by this is a quality issue or this is a reliability issue. And so I have a problem with that. So how did they define those two things? How did they determine something was one versus the other?
Right. Well, that was the first thing I dug into because it raised alarms because before I was going to analyze the data, it matters tremendously how you've initially grouped it in those three buckets, you know, of quality, use life, or wear out. And they were sorting it by time to fail. So if it failed in less than 90 days, it was considered a quality failure. And if it failed in this, you know, next time period was use life and the last time period was wear out. And
then we get different treatments if they failed at different time points?
Well, the first thing that would happen is they get a different strategy for analysis. So if you're deciding, all right, I want to see what, you know, the Weibull shape parameters or behavior is for wear out, you grab all the ones that are wear out. But if you've miscategorized them, you're going to pull the wear out in way sooner than it actually is because you've quality defects effectively included in there or use stress that are pulling it in.
What happens if they're in the first 90 days, they find out some button wears out?
So I find that vice versa.
It's unlikely, but if they misassemble it, it could cause unusual wear and it wears out quicker.
It could be likely, but if it's truly a wear out, it's going to occur across the board, right? So if you've designed it and selected a button that, you know, let's say you know, this is a legacy product and you know that they last, you know, it's the button is capable of it. It was selected mm-hmm. to do it. It showed it in test. And then you're seeing a bunch of these button failures early on. There's something with regard to either variability of the way it's being used, the environment, or how you're making it. Mm-hmm. That's
typical.
Driving this small population to do that. So I didn't want to give them analyses, you know, viable shapes bucketed in one of those three buckets that the data effectively wasn't, you know, was miscategorized. And the reason why I expressed concern over that is I said, what could happen is you direct resources in the wrong direction, which is really why we're doing this, is to reduce the field failure rate. We don't care which area it's in. We just want to reduce it, as mm-hmm. you're saying. But if you've categorized your failures as wear out, you're going to approach this from an improving the design perspective and direct your engineers towards the design and core technology.
Yeah, or yell at your suppliers.
Right. Which is an extension of that same team, right?
Right.
But if you correctly categorize this as, hey, we primarily are really dealing with quality issues. We need to really look closely at our manufacturing process. We need to look closely at where sensitive the variabilities are. You know, you're directing the resource in a very different area. It's not the design. You're starting off with the design sensitivity of variability and what variabilities occur. So
You're sorting by time of when it occurs instead of the failure mechanism. Right?
No. You asked me how they sorted it.
Right.
I'm not
saying
how I would have done it.
Right.
I just that's the way that they had initially grouped the data sets. That's mm-hmm. you know, so that was before really digging in exactly to the type of failure.
Right.
And not the time it occurs, because that, you know, bathtub curve, whether you like it or not, the idea is that you have those three major contributing factors, and all three of them contribute to all three phases.
Right.
It's just how much, which ones are dominant, right? So you could be grouping things as quality defects, and you should see it still contributing in use life and whatever, but much smaller. Mm. But just in
now, you know, I have the idea of bucketing stuff that happens shortly after the customer has gotten it, first 30 days or 90 days. That's often a technique, but for a very different reason than, you know, how I'm going to treat or look at the bathtub curve or what kind of failures it is. Those are more painful. Those impact your brand loyalty more so. They're more likely to do an adverse Yelp review or talk bad about you at a conference or, oh, it's, you know, I had all these dead on arrival type issues.
Right.
Those I can understand, or any organization saying, hey, this failed soon. We should fix that and apply different resources to it, do a more detailed failure analysis, do all the due diligence just because it happened unexpectedly early. Whereas it sounds like this group is saying, well, if it's in the first 90 days, we'll give it to the quality group to go look at it with a manufacturing idea as our first best guess. And I agree. Many times that's the right place to go. Yet it seems kind of the cart before the horse or type approach, though. But it affects more than just where you go solve the problem. You were doing data analysis on this stuff, as you mentioned that. And commingling this or separating the data, you're truncating your data set in these different artificial buckets. Mm-hmm. That's not good.
Well, it's not the end all as far as, you know, what you do in the end, but it was, I guess the motivation there is if you're trying to characterize behaviors, if you're going to have much better characterization, if you do an initial parsing out. I mean, of course, you're going to continue to adjust and play with it. It's an iterative process, data analysis. Mm-hmm. But I think if you have – there was a factor of 10 in timeline between the first thing they were calling wear out and the last thing. And mm-hmm. I'm like, this is just not going to in any way represent a primary – if you want to characterize a primary wear out failure mode, basically one or two specific failure modes out of what might be 20. If I want to characterize those two, I want to isolate the data set as much as possible initially around those two. Mm-hmm. So I'm correctly categorizing it, right?
Right,
and then
right,
you
right.
move on from there. So when you have just insanely broad, you know, range of what you're calling wear out failure modes, I'm like, we're really not characterizing anything. You know, it's, you're not, you can't pick out somebody's voice profile in a room where there's 15 people talking. It's just not going to happen. You're just going to have a static decibel level. Mm-hmm, you're not going to have any characterization of anybody individually. So that was kind of my thing.
Well, it's also, yeah, it's just another way to sort it. And I think the idea of categorizing it by how old the product is, I think is a misapplication of the bathtub curve. And I think you're seeing that also. Whereas
you couldn't even start with it as a way to start to kind of begin to shape. I mean, it's like saying, you know, you can't sculpt with a hammer, but you do kind of start with a hammer to take out big chunks in a marble piece to get to the finesse, right?
No, if I get a failure back in 30 days or a dead on arrival and it started a fire, I'm going to devote resources to solve that one because it's a safety problem, especially if it's a product that's not supposed to start a fire. I much look at the consequence to the customer as the sorting routine, and then look at the second criteria is then how likely is this to be in all of our other products? It's start the triage by the impact to the customer. And how important it is to our brand and our perception of reliability, independent of when it happens. If I have a product that it combusts and it's not supposed to, I'm thinking of these lithium ion batteries issues over the last few years. They didn't need one or two issues, and it didn't matter whether it was out of box or after 2 years. It was a problem, and it got solved. So that's an extreme case. Now, if you're getting dozens and dozens every month, and you need some way to triage this thing, it's look at the failure mode. You know, at least by the subsystem, is this an electronics problem, a mechanical problem, an installation problem? It's sort it by something that helps you then get it closer to the failure mechanism. Not time doesn't help you there, and be prepared to be surprised. And I don't. Yes, in general, in very broad theoretical general, and you know how well theory works. In theory, it works. In practice, it doesn't. If I get failures in out-of-box experience failures, yes, typically we start looking at manufacturing. But by shipping it straight to the quality and manufacturing folks first, we waste a week if it's not related to that. And then sorting the data by that, just by time, I think muddles the information and hides things that otherwise you should be able to spot. It's much more informative and useful for both the solving the problem, doing the failure analysis and solving it wherever the problem may lie, and doing the data analysis if you know what the failure mechanism is.
I agree with what you're saying, but I also think that you're coming at it where a different question was asked. The scenario I described was, hey, we have a bunch of failure data. Nothing's on fire. Nothing's going crazy. Mm-hmm. Can you help us categorize it? Because we want to know more about where we can improve. You know, what is it, quality? Is it wear out? Is the, you know what I mean? Like those types of things help us.
To answer that question, different. You still need the failure analysis, right?
No, of course. But it's a different question than, holy crap, these really bad things are happening. Everybody work on these things, right? So then you just take any data associated you believe to that thing and just, you know, go at it. I agree to what you're saying.
Well, if you're looking at it, if you like they dump, here's 10 years of our product history and we've got failures over different times, the initial analysis, and especially if it's nothing major, there's a range of different things that are failing, looking at it at the system level, what I'm looking for in that regard, is there a dominant mechanism? Is there a hockey stick approach in, say, a Weibull plot? Is there some phenomena that says, hey, what's happening there versus early on and vice versa and stuff? And what's the expected system level performance over time? It's about all you can do with it until you break it into, at least by subsystem or by major components of. A lot of times that's all you get is repair data. They said, oh, we fixed this and it worked. You're lucky if you get good failure analysis data. But I have two problems. One is the data gets muddled by artificially sorting it by time. So if something fails in 89 days, it gets a different analysis than if it failed in 92 days, and it could be exactly the same failure mechanism. So I'm artificially truncating my data from one group to the other just arbitrarily, where if I'm looking at it's a power supply problem, then it doesn't matter how old it is. It's a power supply problem. And then my first pass at analysis will say, do I have mixed failure modes? Are there a couple of things happening here? Do I need better data, or do I more resolution to this? Or is it is the power supply overall okay against this, say, a system level model? Years ago, we had a client that had was really getting hammered in the market. It was a small market, and the number of customers out there were small. There's some competitors, and they were getting lots of feedback that their product just wasn't reliable. So we did something like you're talking about, is we got a pile of data, and they were looking at a new design, and they didn't know what they needed to fix. If you asked the mechanical guys, it was the chassis. If you asked the electrical guys, it was the compressor. If you asked the user interface guys, it was that. They all had their own buckets they wanted to go solve. Mm-hmm. So we broke it down by subsystem. We went back through their data and said, oh, this was this symptom, this failure was in the compressor. This was in the transducers. This was in, you know, different parts. And we did a Weibull plot by subsystem. And the chassis had a decreasing failure rate, but it dominated the early failures. It was installation damage when we dug into it, as people would drag it over stairs or drop it off the truck, or they did all kinds of stuff like that that just damaged the chassis of this thing. And then the second most dominant subsystem that caused failures was a wear out. So it had a much steeper slope on the Weibull curve. But software and the user interface and the electronics were all in the noise. We could double their reliability and it wouldn't matter at all. Mm-hmm. And so we had basically two Paretos at two different timelines. So the early failures was dominated by the chassis and everything else was in the noise. And then after right near the end of the warranty period, this wear out mechanism was starting to dominate, and we was heading towards like 15% of their products was affected by that part. Whereas the software team now shut up, the electronics guys got quiet. they realized that if we fix those two things, the overall system would improve. But if I would have just sorted the data by categories, you know, maybe I would have gotten there, maybe not. But it was, the chassis stuff was damaged sometimes in the first week and sometimes after 6 months, because it was the second installation that chassis damage occurred. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things. So when we first looked at the data, it was really the most resolution I could get was the subsystem. And then we dug deeper once we saw these two areas that we wanted to get more resolution on. So we then got products back. We did more teardown, more failure analysis. They didn't do great failure analysis to start. Mm. Now, the second thing is, and I've seen it in a number of organizations where it comes in, and if it's in the first 90 days, they ship it off to one team. And then if it's after 90 days, they give it to another team and it may have a lower priority. Well, why don't you just take a quality engineer and a design engineer and put them on the same team and let them together sort out?
Right.
Because you know my opinion on manufacturing. It's always the design's fault. Manufacturing Sure. can't make it reliable. They can make it worse, right? But if it's not reliable, it's because the design isn't right. Even if it was a manufacturing error, they made it difficult to manufacture, right? So it's make that a cross-functional team and go solve the problem presented, not artificially sorted.
Yeah. I mean, you just can't be hardlined about it. I agree that I will agree with you that it's way too hardlined if when it comes in the door, you have a date cut off and it goes to a different group. Or, I mean, that's just ridiculous. You're never right. You're going to lose. You could have a whole group of failures that are, you know, right on that 90 day thing, and half of them go one way and half go the other. Mm-hmm. I totally agree with that. That's too far. But I don't disagree that an individual looking at it can use that as an initial parsing that then identify things, and that might bring you to regroup it different ways. But I don't, it sounds like you believe there's harm in doing it, even if an individual does it, which I don't believe. I think it can be a good initial parse to then go from, and you're on an exploration. So wherever you go, you go. But
I'd say, if you're parsing it by symptom, by subsystem or by failure mechanism, I think it's a reasonable way to go, is you're building a Pareto. But building a Pareto by time, no.
Mm, okay.
No. The caveat to that is the stuff that fails early should, especially early in the production cycle as you're launching a product, it should get hypersensitivity to any failure, and the whole team should be addressing it and to drive down your failure mechanisms before you make more of them that are bad. I think those pay off tremendously. And then second is early failures are just more painful. They sting your customer more so than a product that's been in providing value for 10, 15 years.
Oh, well, I mean, especially today when people are, how many people do you know are looking for a reason to replace something? They want it to break after a certain period of time because they want the latest tech, but their spouse says you can't get it until this breaks. You know what I mean?
Like, well, I don't know about
people
that.
People don't care as much.
I don't know about that. I buy pots and pans, the all-clad stuff that I buy them because I know that I can hand them off to my kids and they'll last for 50 years.
I understand. Right. But no, I understand.
It's not the link, but they have this new, induction stuff and all the other great. The new phone came out, right? The iPhone 8 and X or 10 or whatever it's supposed to be called is out. And I'm looking at my phone going, it still works. I still, I updated the operating system. I don't have an issue with battery power. I don't need to update it.
No, I understand. I understand that. That's your. We're very practical and pragmatic. And I know that Warren Buffett still, or the guy, not Warren Buffett, but the founder of Walmart still drives his 1972 pickup, and Warren Buffett still lives in the house he bought in 1960. So yeah, but I mean, there definitely is with high tech products. There definitely is. I mean, I'm reinforcing your point that people care a lot less later down the line, but even more than they used to because technology moves so quick. There is a little bit of like, oh, cool, I get to buy, the one with Bluetooth, my new whatever, powered drill with Bluetooth.
Well, I understand your point, I agree. And Kirk wrote a really nice article. It's called the Drain in the Bathtub Curve, which I thought was a clever title because if you buy a new phone every year, you never get into the battery just not charging because it wears out. Kind of thing where the charging circuit or the lithium ion won't take a charge anymore because you've done 200,000 cycles of charging. We're not even going to get close to that. You get rid of it and you trade it in for the new phone. That's slowing down with iPhones. I think there's some worry in the market that that's not cool enough, new enough tech that it's going to drive the replacement other than the fanboys. They go out and buy the new thing anyway. But cars are like that, right? It used to be a reliability concern. You'd buy a new car every 3 years because unless you were like you, Adam, an auto mechanic that would fix anything, my dad would say, no, I just need my car to work. So he would get a new car every 2 to 3 years. Whereas now 10 years is reasonable and you should get good service out of it. And so I think part of our expectations have changed, but also our reliance on things have changed. The idea of the bathtub curve is another area that I think is just, it's like MTBF. It doesn't exist. It's a nice vehicle to teach that different products can fail in different ways, right? Could be a subset of your product and it is manufactured incorrectly or it's damaged early on and it's a subset. And it will appear like a decreasing failure rate as the overall population. But it's not. It's just this screw comes loose and it falls out.
No, exactly. I mean, actually, if you look at my book, I put next to the bathtub curve another chart showing what a real one looks like. And it's basically a ton of squiggly lines going left to right.
Right, right.
And, they all are dramatically different. I think with the bathtub curve, the idea is that it doesn't exist. But if the idea is that if you were to take a sum of basic dominant factors and you looked at a million different products, you'd see a little bit of a behavior like this. You would see this general trend, which like you said, and it ends up being a very valuable way to communicate different types of failure modes and the value and the understanding of different types is how you approach, improving it. You can't take tires and have, 60,000 mile tires. And if your product goal is to be the first one to make 90,000 mile tires, you're not going to do it by continuously improving your manufacturing process. You're going to do it by doing R&D in rubber technology, you know, because wear out is a fundamental design characteristic. It's not a variability. You know,
you see, that's where I disagree, Adam, is it's a design problem when I run over a nail and I get a flat in the first day of use.
That's not a design problem.
It is a design problem. If it's not steel belted, if it can't withstand driving over the roads I drive on, then it's never going to make 90,000. But so they make the tread to last 90,000. But if they can't survive the roads around here for 10,000, they still have too many problems.
Wait, we're not defining design problem the same. To me, a design problem is you have a design specification and your design – you have a design problem if you can't meet that specification. Within that design specification is what it can handle running over, what environment.
Right. I agree. So they can't make 90,000 unless they make the first 10. And there's a different set of risks. It's not tread wear in the first 10,000 miles, right?
But they'll actually write in that it's not their problem or under warranty if you puncture.
I'm not going to buy a 90,000 tire if it can't survive it going in and out of my driveway.
But you're not supposed to have big nails in your driveway.
Yeah, I got contractors there. They do that.
Right. But I'm
but
just
I also, I drive to the dump. It's my environment.
That Michelin has no accountability if you stick a big nail in it, which you can buy a road hazard program from Tire Rack or something, a distributor, but you can't go to Michelin because in their design spec, it's not supposed to, that tire that you purchase for your vehicle is not supposed to handle running over nails. It's not.
It's part of my environment.
But you bought the wrong tire if that's your environment. Oh, they sell tires for that. They sell truck tires. They sell flat tires. They sell tires that are solid rubber for vehicles that move slow and are on construction sites.
Yeah, I should get one of those.
But I'm just saying they have many products and you obviously selected the wrong one if that really is your environment, a construction zone.
But the issue is that where I draw a line with you, Adam, is that if it's a wear out mechanism, it's a design problem. And if it's not a wear out, it's a manufacturing problem. No. I can design a really bad product that is unsuitable for its environment and it fails early in its life. So if 10% of the population uses the iPhone 6 but uses it underwater, it's in the data sheet, don't get it wet, right? But if a significant proportion of the population gets it wet, it's a design solution to solve that. Now, getting a phone wet is not a wear out mechanism, right? The fundamental mechanism itself is corrosion, which is a wear out phenomena, but it can happen the first day or the last day. So it's going back to that parsing by where it is in the time zone.
No. The wear out's corrosion. When you drop it in water, it stops working instantly. You've shorted it out. That's not
If it's dirty water and if it corrodes over a week, then it's really a problem. Either way, it doesn't matter until you know what the failure mechanism is.
Right.
And just because it happened in the first day or the last day of the warranty period, you still need to know the failure mechanism. You open it up and is it corrosion or is it a dead short?
iPhone has a way of knowing if it was killed by water or not, and they won't cover it if it's killed by water.
It was exposed to water, right? But now the issue is that enough people had water damage that Samsung and Apple and others are now saying, hey, we're going to make it so it's more resistant to water. And you can – there's an ad. I think it was the Samsung ad. The guy's just pouring champagne over it the whole way.
There's a design need, and they're designing a new product, but that doesn't
– for champagne exposure, quite read the spec correctly.
Exactly. But the thing is, though, what you just described is different. You described that they've identified a new market, a need, and they're going to design a new product to do that. But that has nothing to do with their existing product, which does not.
Well, the solution is not say, all right, sorry, we're not covering that. Is make a better design. And it solves a early problem.
But that's not anything to do with the product that's out right now. That's why they don't. That's why if they detect you dropped it in water, they're like, you dropped it in water. You're not supposed to. We're not covering it. Like, I mean, that's I experienced that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I jumped in the lake and I was like, oh, I had that moment where like I was actually in the air.
Oops.
And I realized my phone was in my pocket.
Uh-oh.
I just had that fraction of a second to be like, oh, crap.
Yeah, yeah. You need to do this, honey, hold my phone instead of hold my beer before you do that.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Well, you know what the mistake is? I bought these cool shorts that are like your summer day shorts. They look mm-hmm. like khaki shorts, but they're actually a bathing suit.
Okay.
So the material like wicks and dries super quick. So like you can go to a picnic, jump in, and then go back to the picnic, right?
Right.
The only
right.
problem is the pockets feel like regular short pockets, like khaki shorts. So you just mm-hmm. throw your phone in and
keys, everything else.
Yeah, your yeah. keys, which also get ruined now because they're electronic, you know, so you forget you have your pockets full.
Oh, man. Oops. Yeah, that would be a bad feeling midair.
And I went to the iPhone store and they were like, sorry. I was like, damn it. You know, it's because their product that I purchased does not cover that. And they're not going to redesign it to do that model.
No,
they might
no.
decide that there's a high enough percentage of people that would buy a model that could do it and make something
and
new.
And they did. But, right. And the market overall said. But I'm thinking of industrial products or all kinds of products that as you, in hindsight, you're looking at field problems. And it's my contention that it doesn't matter when it occurs, it's the design's fault.
Wait. I have the perfect way to describe what the difference of what I'm saying and you're saying
okay.
is the way they address. So I was describing myself as a reliability engineer dealing with data. So right. let's say for that iPhone, I don't know what it was, the iPhone 5, you know, they analyze their data of ones that come back that have to get fixed and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they see that 10%, as you were saying, that are water damage.
Right.
Here's how you get proof on how they categorize it. Did they do a panic recall and design fix, you know, so let's say they have the technology to make it waterproof, which mm-hmm. they do. And let's say it adds a lot of cost or whatever. So did they panic and say, oh my God, you know, we have 10% failure rate, you know, associated to this. And they did a recall and sent out a new fix for mm-hmm. everybody, mm-hmm. right? Or did they say, 10% of the market, I bet you people would spend more on a phone if it had this feature. And they made it part of the iPhone 6.
Right.
But wait, they did the latter. Right. Which shows that they saw an interesting need and did it.
Mm-hmm.
When Samsung's batteries caught fire, they said, we sold a product's not supposed to catch fire. And they did a recall and they resubmitted, you know, so I mean, that's the difference.
Yeah. And it's tied to the failure mechanism. If both groups would have said, oh, these are early failures, we'll send it to quality and tell them to make them and manufacture them better as their first course of action. I think it artificially puts them in the wrong bucket. And you've seen it in your data analysis where if the data isn't, if you don't have the rich enough data set, it's really hard to analyze it and to make sense of it and ask the right questions out of it. And so I think at the start of this, that sorting it by time and sorting it based on the concept of the bathtub curve, I think it's just a bad start to doing that. It's much better look at, oh, this caused fire. It didn't matter when. It caused harm. We got to deal with that. And then
the water one's different.
Yeah.
I get the fire one.
The like water one's different. It's a business decision. How are we going to solve it? And if it would have been a software fix, they could have rolled it out the next iOS.
But when you analyze it by category after you said that, so basically that's what I'm getting at. So you said, oh, this is a business thing. And then you say, well, how should we categorize this? And you say, is this a quality defect? We could improve our manufacturing process. You're like, nope. You know, is this, and then you'd eventually say, no, this is a use case, environmental case
right.
specification that's beyond. And then you approach it with a design solution instead of a manufacturing.
In practice, I think if they're sorting it and they send it to a different team, I think the group is a bit short-sighted in that it's just going to waste a little bit of time. And yeah, most of the time they're going to be right, but I think they're going to miss. If you're predisposed to think that this is a manufacturing issue, I'm going to pull up my manufacturing improvement tool set and do my best to try to fix that. And every now and then I'm going to throw one back over to the design team saying, hey, fix that. Whereas I'm suggesting is that don't make that decision until you know what the problem is. Do the mm-hmm. failure analysis, do the root cause, do the triage with both sets of skill sets looking at it and going, oh, well, because many, many problems are a mix, right? It's great to be a waterproof design if I put the seal in, right?
And vice versa. The water one's not a mix. No, the water one's not a mix.
No. What I'm saying is if I can make a waterproof design and I can manufacture it improperly, or I could have such a tight tolerance.
That's a different problem.
Well, but you need to find out what the problem is before you send it off to somebody to go solve.
Yeah,
I think.
Okay.
do that first. And then the data gets sorted correctly, the analysis and the fixes get sorted correctly and so on. But sorting strictly by time, I think, is a waste of time.
I agree. No, I agree that that's not.
All right.
Well, all right. Well, I think we
beat the Dale head out of this one.
We knew we would. It was a good one. Well, I'm glad we got to talk about it. I'm sure we'll talk about it more. So.
Yeah. So I don't know if we're in violent agreement or not, but I think there are different ways to do it. And I'm open to being proved wrong. So if a listener is going, nah, I'm full of it and you're with you, Adam, they should let us know. Head over to reliability.fm. And leave us a comment. Send us an email and let us know where you come down on this. We'd love to hear from you. And then it may very well prompt another whole episode for us to talk about it yet another way.
Definitely. All right. Well, thanks, Fred. And thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.